Copland already, when he was in his early 20s, was thinking about what would it mean to be American in terms of an American concert composer. And, you know, that was part of the evolution of this country, the cultural and artistic evolution of this country in all fields, in literature, in painting, in so many ways. What does it mean to define this country culturally? And this was one of the, you know, one of the places that Copland started out. It didn't mean that he himself pursued a career that was sort of stylistically uniform and constrained, because we know that one of the defining factors of Copland's own work was his receptivity to all kinds of stimulus. And sometimes it might be, you know, Viennese 12-tone music, Viennese serialism, or sometimes it would be the American West, or sometimes it would be jazz. And, you know, this was something that I think kept him fresh throughout his life, was this kind of the openness to all kinds of outside stimuli. First for him was, how do I create what he explicitly called a recognizably American musical idiom?
That's the Allegro Giusto movement from Quartet for Piano and Strings by Aaron Copland, played by music from Copland House on their debut album, Chamber Music of Aaron Copland. And what an album. There's just so much there. I mean, you hear all of Copland's many, many interests in jazz and 12-tone music, I mean, in creating an American sound. I chose that movement to open the program with because I felt like it's kind of like Copland in miniature in a way. There's just so many elements of Copland's music all packed into that movement. And what a fantastic performance as well. And we're hearing the voice of Michael Boryskin, who played piano on that recording. And he's also the artistic and executive director of Copland House. I would say he's really the driving force behind so much of what Copland House does. Welcome to Relevant Tones. I'm Seth Bosted. This is the first in a two-part series about the Copland House. And I'm not going to say too much more about Copland House because Michael does an incredible job explaining the history and mission of this important organization. All of the music I'm featuring on this episode was created by composers in collaboration with Copland House. And if you want to know what you're hearing, you want to know about the pieces and the composers, you can find that information in the show description, however you're hearing this podcast, or you can go to relevanttones.com. Okay, let's dive in.
You know, it's interesting because, I mean, I think there were a lot of people thinking about this, but Copland was particularly successful, right, in doing all the things that you said, inhaling all of these influences and then putting them out, and it's recognizably Copland and it's recognizably American. I mean, I think that is a really interesting thing to be able to do and to be, you know, it's such a large country, and yet you really can, in the classical idiom, kind of trace it back to one guy, Aaron Copland, which is pretty remarkable, it seems.
Well, you know, it is, and it really speaks to his having the chops, the technical chops to be able to do that. We know that, you know, quite a number of composers tried, but as you said, he somehow always rose to the top in whatever he was trying to do, whatever, you know, whatever aspect. I mean, remember, too, that, you know, he really revolutionized film music in the earlier days, of sound, meaning, you know, already the late 30s, early 40s, he created that kind of, you know, World War II era, kind of lean, muscular kind of sound that really suited film out of this country. Again, you go back to, you know, you go back, you know, a half a generation, and film music was also defined largely by Europeans who had come to this country and ended up becoming based in Hollywood. And that notion of the sweeping sort of post-romantic or high romantic European lush luxuriant style of Wagner and Strauss and you know, Korngold, was the defining sound of film music in this country for, you know, the decade and a half of sound. And it really was Copland getting involved with Hollywood productions, you know, around 1940 and thereafter. He, you know, he thinned that out. He made that American also.
What's always extraordinary about him is not only everything we're talking about with the musical chops and you know, I mean, the synthesis and creating what we think of as a recognizably American orchestral sound, among other things. But he was also such an advocate for composers. I mean, you know, a big mover and shaker behind the American Music Center and, of course, creating Copland House. I mean, that is something I think that you find in Copland very early on as well, right? This idea that he's going to use his position once he gains it to advocate for other American composers.
Absolutely. And that's, frankly, that's a key to Copland House and what it's about. Copland was a singular colleague and, you know, call it musical citizen as well. And he was doing this from the time he was in his 20s. This isn't something that he came to, it's something I should do because I, you know, I'm a internationally renowned composer, and now I can help to bestow my celebrity status on younger composers. He was doing this from the time he was an emerging composer in his 20s. I don't think enough is known about that. And I have to say that is really the thing, the animating thing about Copland House, much more than the music. You know, Copland's music doesn't need our help. It was really Copland as a kind of peerless champion for his fellow composers. There was no such thing for him as a competitor or a rival. They were all colleagues and fellow composers. And he, you know, he was active in helping to start publishing houses and record companies, and helping to guard the composers' rights as creators and royalties. And he was either a founder or a key early supporter or participant of so many entities that have since become fixtures on the American musical landscape.
Thank you. Thank you.
this origin story of Copeland House is also emblematic of the kind of high regard that people had for Copeland himself. Everything he did, as we've been saying, everything he did throughout his life was strongly involved with championing American music and American composers. And actually, when he died, there was no provision for his home, his longtime home, where he lived the last 30 years of his life, lived here longer by far than any other place. And it was his only home still in existence. And he actually created, typically Copeland, typical Copeland gesture, he created a grant-making trust, which was intended to support American music projects, which has become known as the Copeland Fund. It really is perhaps the largest funder of American music projects anywhere. And the plan was for the house to be sold, actually, and for the proceeds of the sale to endow a few more of those grants every year, which is a perfectly defensible decision to have been made. And indeed, the for sale sign went up at the front of the house, and some of the neighbors got wind of it. And they saw the sign and said, wait a minute, they can't do this. This was Mr. Copeland's house. He was an important guy, and they didn't want to let that stand. And they went to the local government, the town government, just about an hour north of New York City, and said, look, you know, you've got to serve as our umbrella. Nobody's going to know who we are, the neighbors, but you've got to go to the Copeland estate and tell them that they can't sell the house. And we have this idea to place the house somehow, some way into the service of American music. Thank you. There were no professionals on that initial grassroots movement. Nobody with, you know, experience or resources or networks. I wasn't a part of that back then. So I speak about all of this with enormous awe and admiration for their vision and their determination. And the short of it is, the town went to the Copeland estate, made this pitch to not sell the house. The estate said, sure, let's try it and see what might happen. And, you know, the short of that is that, you know, they helped to sort of fix up the house and get it ready for programming. It was kind of around that time that I got involved. The house at that point, before it was opened, was kind of overseen by a volunteer steering committee of people who were very actively involved in American music. Copeland's publishers, Ed Boosey and Hawks, some very prominent American authors and music historians, Copeland's co-biographer Vivian Perlis from Yale University. So, you know, I was delighted to be a part of that group. And you know, the short of it is that, you know, we started to devise some programming and we opened the doors, and as they say, build it and they'll come. You know, we've never looked back. The house has really been animated by everything Copeland did as an individual to support the work of composers and to contribute to the what you might call the infrastructure of American music. And you know, we're now at the point where we've just purchased a large additional property, which we've long needed, which will help us continue our institutional and programmatic expansion. But all of that comes from who Aaron Copeland was as a person, as opposed to who he was as a composer.
Thank you.
Everybody is passionately committed to to this work. I certainly have felt strongly that a lot of the issues that face the concert music field stem from the fact that for way too long, way too many people have been doing way too many of the same sorts of things. And there is an enormous sense of diversity. And I use that in the broadest sense. Goodness knows that that word has become way loaded. But there is a massive amount of repertory and material which just goes unheard. And this notion of the disconnect between old and new, older and newer, is something that is almost unique to the concert music field. And that's created a vast amount of problems in terms of really connecting with with a wider public, with maintaining our place on, the daily radar, maintaining a sense of relevance. And I think all we can do is certainly the way I approach things personally and artistically is, we need to build, each of us, we need to build our own world. And maybe that, radiates by example. This is what we do. These are the lines that we draw in the sand. These are the things we want to be doing. These are the kind of standards that we're, that we're looking to meet. And we hope you like it. And we hope we're contributing something valuable to to the discourse, to the conversation, to the field itself. that was really an animating factor for us, that we felt that we wanted a program that could actively champion early career professional composers, young composers, gifted young composers who were just starting out. And it wasn't simply to, you know, highlight a few of them and move on. This is really an intensive creative workshop and mentoring program. It's week long. It involves Copland House commissioning a select number of composers who are designated as fellows, Cultivate Fellows, who are chosen each year. There are no more than six fellows, and they are commissioned, we commission them to write an intentionally short work for small ensemble of a mixed quartet or a mixed quintet, usually a mixed quartet. And the piece is explicitly somewhere in the 5 to 7 minute range, 5 to 8 minute range. And the reason for that is that we wanted this to be really a deep dive into the creative process and to composing.
And that brings us to the end of part one of Copland House. So I hope you'll tune in next week for part two. I'll feature more music created in the Cultivate program by Copland House, and I'll chat with Michael about that program and other aspects of Copland House. So hope you'll tune in for part two of Copland House. Relevant Tones is a production of Access Contemporary Music, a nonprofit organization with the mission of providing equitable access to the transformative power of music making. Find out more at acmusic.org. On behalf of Relevant Tones, I'm Seth Bosted. Thanks so much for listening.